you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Of course, Dr. Jones is the editor of Culture Wars magazine and the author of several very important books, including The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, and the soon-to-released The History of Logos and Logos of History, right?
Yes.
And I guess you, last time I heard you say there's light at the end of the tunnel for that book?
Yes, they're getting brighter every day.
Okay.
I just finished a chapter on Matthias Josef Schaben and Friedrich Nietzsche.
Oh, okay. I've heard of Nietzsche and I've heard of Schaben, so that'd be interesting.
You've heard both? You've heard of Schaben?
No, I said I've heard of Nietzsche, of course, but not of Schaben.
Yeah, no one knows about Schaben. So it's a very interesting chapter in that regard.
Okay, so yeah. Okay, great. Okay. So, well, tonight I wanted to talk to you about the latest, of course, this month, the July-August issue of Culture Wars, which is on Jewish privilege. And you wrote an article by that title for that edition. And, well, Jewish privilege, what is Jewish privilege?
It's the ability to completely dominate the narrative, to be above the rules, to dictate to other people how they should behave, and get away with it. This is the whole thing in a nutshell. The crucial issue right now is speech, hate speech, and the control of discourse on the internet. Hate speech is a total creation of the Anti-Defamation League. It is completely Jewish from start to finish. It is Jewish prejudice imposed on the rest of the world. And the main Jewish prejudice is that no one is allowed to criticize the Jew. Hate speech gets defined as a completely empty category into which they can put you anytime they want. You have no recourse. If they say it's hate speech, you're guilty, and you're not going to be even proven innocent. It's that it's completely arbitrary. It's a completely tyrannical imposition on the last bastion of what America stands for, which is freedom of speech.
Now, how did the ADL in particular, and say maybe the Jews in general, gain such power?
Through criminal activity, for the most part. That's the tip of the iceberg. One of the main contributors to the ADL was Meyer Lansky. Meyer Lansky's granddaughter now works for the ADL in some capacity. Meyer Lansky was a notorious criminal. Another notorious criminal was Mo Dalitz. Mo Dalitz was involved in Cincinnati, the Newport, Kentucky, right across the river from Cincinnati, gambling, prostitution, and during Prohibition, alcohol. He was one of the chief figures in the Jewish Navy, which was the group that brought alcohol from Canada, from the Bronfman Distillery, across Lake Erie into Cleveland or across the Detroit River into Detroit. So he was a major figure, and the trajectory of Mo Dalitz is even more interesting than the one than of Meyer Lansky. Mo Dalitz gave money to the ADL, and the ADL then used that money. This is man who's involved in criminal activity giving money to an organization like the ADL. This is known as money laundering. Okay, this is how he got into the legit economy. So Mo Dalitz went to Las Vegas, which is a Jewish creation, and it's based on gambling. And what you see over this period is the pressure on legislatures across the country to legalize gambling, which means legalizing Jewish control over the political process, because that's what it comes down to. Classic example is Sheldon Adelson. What's the difference between Sheldon Adelson and Meyer Lansky? Well, gambling is no longer illegal. That's the difference. And why is it no longer illegal? Largely because of Jewish lobbying, because this was a major source of Jewish money, and Jewish money is a major source of political influence. So the crucial moment in this trajectory came in 1984 when William Webster invited the ADL into a partnership with the FBI. Now, this is the same year that the ADL gave its Torches of Liberty Award?
Yeah, I think it's Liberty, to, yeah.
Torches of Liberty Award to none other than Mo Dalitz. You suddenly realize, well, wait a minute, if Mo Dalitz, if the ADL is now in partnership with the FBI and they're giving Mo Dalitz an award, it's a sure bet that the FBI is not going to go after Mo Dalitz, right? Even though he was under investigation by the FBI for his entire adult life. So you're seeing here the mutual corruption of the FBI, which was never a purely clean operation. It was always a blackmailing operation. And I think the Jews held the FBI in check because the ADL was another blackmailing organization. They would keep files on people like J. Edgar Hoover, and probably have pictures of him in his pink nightie, and would use this to keep him under control. So you're seeing here the inner grammar of the hidden grammar of political corruption in the United States revolving around Jewish privilege. These people became exempt from prosecution because they were Jewish. And because anybody, now that didn't happen to Meyer Lansky, but it did happen to Mo Dalitz. And what happened here is any Jew who made a significant contribution to the ADL could be assured of immunity from prosecution.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, yeah, of course, you mentioned there was, I think it was 1930s when the ADL kind of teamed up with the FBI, as you suggested, that was probably a product of a combination of blackmail and bribery, because you mentioned in the article that not only was he blackmailed, but he was also, Hoover, that is, was also an inveterate gambler, horse racing, and his gambling was managed by the Sterling National Bank, which was a Lansky establishment, right?
Right, right. So there are all kinds of unsavory connections here that you're not allowed to talk about. You know, there was a time when it was simply polite people never talked about that kind of stuff. And we all want to be polite, so we never talked about it. And then it got to the point where, wait a minute, there's too much to talk about here. We're going to start talking about it. And at this point, we have draconian speech codes descending on everyone. And it's a Jewish operation. There is no question that hate speech is Jewish. Read the go to the ADL website. They brag about it. And what are we talking about here? What are we talking about? Well, the same group that was involved in overturning the moral order in the 1960s, specifically in sexual issues. You have a guy like Leo Pfeffer, the lawyer for the AJC, who was involved in litigating a number of Supreme Court cases, the school prayer decision, one of them, Shemp versus Abington. You have them involved in obscenity cases because the Jews run the pornography business, and it's in their interest. And so over this period of time, the Jews claim that they're in favor of free speech. Well, this is a laugh. I mean, would anyone today say that Jews were in favor of free speech? No, they're in favor of the opposite, because over this period of time, they took control of discourse. And now they are in total control of it, or they'd like to be in total control. And now they can dictate the terms on which we're allowed to talk to each other. So what happened is you had a real social order, which was based on a real moral order, always under threat, because it always is. And that was abolished. And the result is anarchy. And now people have to come in and say, no, now we're going to impose another order. Well, this one is obviously not going to be logical, because you abandon the logic being based on logos. You abandon that logical order. And now this is going to be purely arbitrary, the order now. And that's going to cause resentment. And resentment is going to cause anger, and anger is going to cause violence. And what we're seeing now is the fulfillment of that trajectory. Okay, what is the flip side of political correctness? The suppression of speech, the suppression of all right of assembly, the suppression of any view that the Jew does not like. It's violence on a daily basis. Okay, and we had this weekend, we had the distinction of having 3 mass shootings within 24 hours. So it's hard to keep up with all of these mass shootings. And then we have the lackey of Jewish interest, Pete Buttigieg, gay mayor of South Bend, immediately saying the problem is white nationalism. The point here is nobody can assemble under that banner. The FBI breaks up organization. If there are 3 guys in a trailer park in Michigan with one single action 22 rifle, the FBI will infiltrate them and bring in explosives and then get them to perform some action. That actually happened. It was called the Hootery, mm-hmm. and it actually happened in Michigan. So I'm not making that up. All unauthorized assemblies are broken up by groups like the FBI. Well, Occupy Wall Street was a legitimate grassroots protest. It got broken up. Now, every time your organization gets broken up, you feel angry about it. And then you're pushed down to the level where you can't associate with anybody, because it's basically against the law. And at that point, you're all by yourself. And then maybe you can chat on the internet, and then that's going to be shut down. At a certain point, certain people just snap. And they say, I can't take it anymore. And they get a gun and they go into Walmart or a school or a synagogue or whatever, and they start shooting people. This is the logical outcome of Jewish privilege. It's the logical outcome. There is no way to get around it. And I said it before I don't know whether we had a discussion on my article on the Poway synagogue shooting, mm-hmm. but I said it then. I said, you know, you, meaning the ADL, you are responsible for this. You are the people who have done this. And what we have now is you got willing executioners of the oligarchs like Pete Buttigieg, who now want to take it even further. Let's confiscate their guns. Let's demonize white people as the source of all of these problems. Fact is, one of the Dayton shooter was a Bernie Sanders supporter, and there was a black guy in Chicago who killed 7 people, and he was black. So there goes that whole thing. Mm-hmm. There is no group. There's no group out there. I guarantee you. It is all individuals, and the problem is they don't know how to stop this type of mayhem, because it's basically unstoppable. How are you going to know? How are you going to know who's the next guy is going to snap? Because he doesn't have to talk to anybody. He just had to make up his mind. There's no communication necessary. Pick up a gun and start shooting people. This is, as I said, the logical outcome of Jewish privilege.
Yet you listen to the political rhetoric, and people will blame hate speech, or what, you know, basically it's political expressions that you don't agree with. And so instead of encouraging free speech, they encourage more suppression, which will, again, create more violence.
Yeah. Explain to me what hate speech is. Tell me what that is.
Well, it's someone I disagree with. Someone whose speech I disagree with, right?
And the point is, you know, who cares whether anybody disagrees with Tim Kelly? Who cares? But if you're a Jew, you have Jewish privilege. Mm-hmm. And if you have Jewish privilege, then you can say, as Michael Brown said to me, you know, we had a debate about 1 Thessalonians 2. The Jews are the people who killed Jesus Christ. They are enemies of the entire human race. Well, he didn't like my interpretation of that. I'm saying what that passage means is that the Jews are the people that killed Christ and they're enemies of the entire human race. Pretty simple. There's no deep hidden meaning here. Okay, but he disagreed with that. So it used to be that an anti-Semite was someone who didn't like Jews, and then it was someone who criticized Jews. Well, now it's anyone who disagrees with a Jew is an anti-Semite. And the proof of that is my debate with Michael Brown. I have to accept his cockamamie understanding of 1 Thessalonians 2, where Jew doesn't mean Jew, it means Judeans. Even though I explained to him, I said, wait a minute, I know the Greek, it's hoi judeoi, that's Jew, that's the Jews. Okay, he has the privilege of calling me an anti-Semite. Now, I can call you a hornswoggler or, a cattle rustler or whatever, you know, and who cares what I say? But anti-Semite, well, that's a career stopping move. You know, that's serious business.
Yeah, they'll shut down your bank account.
And at that point, and there's only one group that has this privilege, and that's the Jews. This is the essence of Jewish privilege. They can call you an anti-Semite, which is the most serious charge you can level against anybody. I mean, let's face it, sodomites praise now, isn't it?
Yes, isn't it? It's the new you're the new revolutionary hero.
Isn't it the noblest thing you can be at this point as a homosexual? So obviously that's gone by the board, but anti-Semite is something that will ruin you if you're in the wrong position. And that's precisely Jewish privilege. They have the right to determine who can get ruined and who cannot. Well, this is it's becoming more and more intolerable. It's always been intolerable. But for some reason, this group has decided to press the issue with their draconian laws about hate speech on the Internet. And that is causing violence. It's that simple.
Well, something like the New Testament, which by definition, you could say is anti-Jewish, but not anti-Semitic. And there's a difference there, correct?
Did you understand that distinction?
Yes.
Why is it that Dr. Brown cannot understand a simple distinction like that? I made it on his program. I said, yes, anti-Semitism is a word that didn't exist until 1871 when Wilhelm Marr invented it. And it has to do with racial differences or racial determinism. And it can make no sense whatsoever if you're talking about the gospel, because everybody there had the same DNA. Okay. So how does, when St. John says the parents of the man born blind refused to speak out of fear of the Jews because the Jews threatened to expel from the synagogue anyone who said that Christ was the Messiah, what, they can't be talking about a racial group. They're all the same racial group. That's impossible. The distinction has to be theological. And that's the whole thesis of my book. I've been saying this for 11 years now, since I published the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. It's the thesis of the book. You can read the book and say it's not about I'm making up here. I'm not saying one thing to one audience and one thing to another. I've been saying this for 11 years, and you can't get through to this guy because he doesn't want to hear it.
Well, that's your interpretation. Wasn't it fear of the Judeans?
What's that mean?
Fear of the radical secularizers.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's not a question of getting through to them. It's a question of them acknowledging. They know they have their privilege, and they have to maintain a certain narrative and also psychological imprisonment of the general population in order, you know, to maintain their power. So they're not willing to engage in illogical, fair discussion. That's something I gather from your article about they're willing to use any means to even exploit the judicial system, the legal system, to suppress free speech.
That's right. And it's not just Dr. Brown, because, you know, we had this discussion where we just refused to admit the simplest distinctions of the sort you just made. And then 2 days later, there's the Poway shooting. And then he does a video blaming me. How many times do we put together a video where I have about 57 clips after another, where every time I say, no one has the right to harm the Jew. No one has the right to harm the Jew. How many times have I said that on the internet? Hundreds of times. But in spite of that, you know, this is hate speech, and I'm responsible for the Poway shootings. My rhetoric is responsible for the Poway shootings. Well, this is preposterous. Okay, and you can just kind of laugh it off until 2 days later, Ambassador Danny Dannon shows up from from Israel, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, and says in his Inspector Clouseau accent that the time for discussion is over. And we are now have to criminalize this behavior. So what I'm talking about, this another thing I could not get through to Dr. Brown, was that there is a group called the Jews. There is a group, you know. It's like the Jews and the Catholics fought over obscenity in the 30s. Well, nobody objects when you say the Catholics were a part of that. But as soon as you say the Jews were the other part, well, that disappears. Well, no, there is a group. And the way this Jewish privilege works is it's because it's the Jewish group taken together. So it's not that Dr. Brown, I never said Dr. Brown wanted to send me to jail, but he'll call me an anti-Semite. And then Dannon wants to send anybody who's an anti-Semite to jail. So you put them two and two together, and it means you disagree with Dr. Brown and you go to jail. That's what we're facing right now. This is intolerable.
Well, if there is an organized Jewry or organized Jewish organizations that you know, collaborate, get, you know, and lobby and influence governmental power or legislation, or even, you know, what's covered in the media, it's determined to be our entertainment fair, you know, our popular culture. How do you explain, you know, things like, I don't know, the fact that Congress passes the anti-BDS legislation, right?
I don't know.
It just happens.
Shit happens. I guess that's what it is. You know, it's just great minds coming together spontaneously without any type of prompting. It was like, you know, the reason that all of those legislators jumped up 27 times when Benjamin Netanyahu spoke is because he's the greatest orator since Demosthenes. It wasn't because IPAC was there in the hall taking notes, even though that's what the New York Times said. Well, wait a minute. This is preposterous. This is not rational. And what you're doing here, Mr. ADL, Mr. Greenblatt, is you're imposing an irrational code on everyone, and people don't like it and they get mad. And some people, when they get mad, they pick up a gun. So you're responsible for it. Don't blame me.
I think this is anticipated and desired. You know, they want nothing more than something like this to happen so they can justify, if not, you know, legislation, at least political rhetoric that will then justify the tech companies from stifling more speech. And
yeah, there is a certainly a plausible train of thought there that I think this is a plausible way of thinking.
Yeah,
I think there is. I mean, it's not as if no one has ever articulated this. Is the whole dialectic that leads to revolution. Mm-hmm. It was that the Poway shooter said it himself from the other point of view. You know, acts of terrorism are supposed to lead to repression. And repression leads to more acts of terrorism. And then finally, the ultimate result is supposed to be revolution. Well, the ultimate result is going to be draconian, more and more draconian control over the culture. You will have fewer and fewer rights. You will not be able to say anything because you don't have Jewish privilege. And so what they do is they create a bogus term called white privilege. I mean, if there's ever a preposterous claim, it's white privilege. I mean, the very fact that you're called white means you're a racist, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Of course it does. Of course it does. This is precisely the rhetoric that Pete Buttigieg is using now in his presidential campaign. As soon as you say you're white, you're guilty. Well, this is the flip side of Jewish privilege, because they are the ones who determine who is guilty and who is not. And so, for example, if you're a Catholic priest and you engage in sex with minors, or you're suspected of it, you're guilty until proven innocent. If you're a Hollywood producer or a Jewish professor at the Harvard Law School, well, then you don't get prosecuted. You get a sweetheart deal.
That's right. Epstein isn't a Jewish scandal. It's his scandal.
Yeah. Shame on you for saying that the Epstein and Dershowitz happen to be Jewish, like Harvey Weinstein. And wait a minute. Is there a pattern emerging here? No, that's a bad thought, because there's no such thing as group as the Jews. It's just individuals like Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, you could go down the line, you know?
And this is the same thing, like something like pornography is socially destructive or culturally destructive as pornography, but they can take credit for, legalizing it, lack of a better term, creating, advocating legislation or legal activism that kind of got it covered, got pornography was now considered free speech, and then expanding its influence and spread in society. But then if you turn around and say, well, the Jews are responsible for pornography, they'll call you an anti-Semite.
Unless you're Professor Abrams, who took my article and then republished it with a few footnotes, and then it's okay. Of course we're for pornography. What's wrong with that? That's the conclusion he comes to. Exactly the same data. It's the same thing, this colossal double standard here.
And the best example of that would sort of this double standard, the twisting of the First Amendment into supporting obscenity but suppressing free speech, would be outfits like YouTube, which is run by Google, where you can surf the net to, you know, all night watching all manner of degenerate pornography. And people that produce that won't be banned or get deplatformed. But if you promote or talk about a political point of view, express a political point of view in which these groups disagree, then you get banned. The First Amendment was supposed to be for political speech, not for
obscenity. That's right. That's exact. This is Jewish privilege. Okay. And secondly, why isn't, I mean, they talk about violence on the internet. Well, isn't pornography violence on the internet? I mean, you know, isn't it violent? Yeah, it is. It is. And as a matter of fact, there were two feminists who said this in the early 90s, Catherine McKinnon and Andrea Dworkin. And they started to get some traction with the idea. And guess who shows up to shut them down? Betty Friedan. Mm-hmm. Shut that down. That's bad feminism. That's not good feminism, because my Jewish friends run the pornography industry. Wow, this is outrageous. Yeah. This is an outrageous double standard. How much hypocrisy do we have to take? How much is going to be forced on us?
Well, what Dworkin and McKinnon didn't understand was, because their doctrine, they're feminist, is although their criticism of pornography was valid, that pornography isn't about freedom, nor is it about male exploitation of women. It's about political control.
Yes, and they weren't sophisticated to know that. Mm-hmm. Read Andrea Dworkin. And the late Andrea Dworkin, read some of her books, the way she talks about human sexuality, and you're dealing with one troubled soul there, yeah. Believe me.
Yeah. Now, one thing I do get from reading your books and this article is that there is an inability of introspection or self-criticism among these Jews. They'll acknowledge that anti-Semitism is sort of this universal human experience. I mean, every culture seems to have it, who has... Every culture, every people who have an exposure to Jews suffer from anti-Semitism, this sort of this psychological disorder. But never are they willing to accept that anti-Semitism, as they see it, is often a reaction to Jewish behavior. Most likely, best expressed in what Ratzinger called Jewish commerce, which usually is engaged in some sort of vice or exploitation.
You so mean
people are reacting to something?
Georg Ratzinger.
Georg Ratzinger, the great uncle of Benedict XVI.
Benedict, yeah. 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 He was very frank about it. That one of the things that annoyed me about these interviews with the Pope is that Zewald mentions Georg and then never pursues the issue. The big issue. Wait a minute. Let's name the book. Jüdisches Erwerbsleben. Well, wait a minute. Can we talk about that? Was your great uncle an anti-Semite? Your Holiness. Not, it was just very frustrating to see this opportunity pass. As a journalist, I just felt really frustrated when that happened, because it's mentioned as if to, okay, now we've checked that off, now we can dismiss it. No, this was serious. There was a serious discussion going on around this time. Georg Ratzinger's book came out around the same time as the Civiltà Cattolica articles, which is to say the early 1890s, mm-hmm. On the Jewish question. It was a legitimate question back then, and people were able to discuss it, and I think the world is better if you're allowed to discuss these issues. I mean, the Jews may not like it, but who gave them total control over our discourse? Who did that?
Well, it's negative feedback, which everyone needs. And also, again, it would encourage some introspection, which seems, as a group, they don't seem capable of doing because of, I guess, because of the Talmud and the way that their worldview of, you know, of tikkun olam, which their role in society is to be revolutionary, which you know, trace all the way back to the foot of the cross. But yes. it's just a problematic outlook that they have. And if they can get away with it, in which they do because the way they function, and when I say they, again, it is a group, there are organizations, and they dominate the narrative through the media, they get into finance and these things, so they're able to, basically control the narrative in society, and also psychologically imprison the general population. This is something that's been more of a problem in the 20th century because of, you know, the Holocaust narrative, and the post-war era is the big, you know, I think is a turning point in the second half of the 20th century. But in the article, you write about St. John Capistrano, and I was reading that, it reminded me of the Jewish question article that the Catholic Church, you know, wrote in Civiltà Cattolica in 1890s. Because it's a very frank and open discussion about the Jewish question, the problems of Jews. And what was his take on it, and what was his solution?
Well, I put that in there because the term, he used exactly that term. He talked about the privileges of the Jews. Yeah. So it's not something I made up. It goes way back, you know, back to the 15th century. Mm-hmm. What he was talking about was basically the arrangement that the prince would make with the Jews. Mm-hmm. The prince was always in need of money, and there was one group that was willing to lend money at the drop of a hat, and that was the Jews. This is kind of memorialized in Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice. So the privileges of the Jews came about because the prince would invite the Jews in on the condition that they lend him money at a low rate. And in order to bring that about, he had to allow them to gouge the population in general with everyone would call usurious rates. The standard was 43 1/3% per year. Now, compared to payday loans, that's good. I mean, so we have the same type of thing. The Jewish privilege here is the payday loan. Dan Gilbert, why isn't Dan Gilbert in jail? Well, because it's all legal now. Usury is legal. It used to be called loan sharking, and gambling is legal. And you put those two things together, and you've got a vacuum cleaner that will just suck in money like you don't believe, you know. And you can basically buy the political process, because the Achilles heel of democracy in America is money. You can buy politicians, and they will stay bought, and they will do what you say. And that is the end of democracy, and it's the end of the American experiment, and blah, blah, blah. And we've reached that endpoint. And that's another factor that contributes to violence, because people realize, I don't have anybody who's representing my interests here. I don't have enough money. The system in the United States is not one man, one vote. It's $1, one vote. And so Sheldon Adelson has billions of votes. And what do I have, you know? Nothing that can compete with him. And so I've been disenfranchised. I thought this was my country. I used to be a patriot. Now I'm angry. Now I got this. And you know, the trajectory. We've seen it happen so many times.
Well, not only are you not a billionaire, you're not a victim like Sheldon Adelson.
Right. Yes, I forgot about that.
And but there, people like Gilbert and Adelson, you know, I look at I think Sheldon Adelson's building in a former Bethlehem steel plant, a casino in Pennsylvania and in Cincinnati. and, you know, the declining industrial economy in the Midwest. He's also, he owns what, the Jack Casino now?
Yeah, that's Dan Gilbert. That's so, not Sheldon.
Yeah, yeah, Dan Gilbert. So you no longer have to go across the river to Newport to squander your meager wages. And
no, you Cincinnati is Sin City now. Yeah,
and I think you're right about that, Meyer Lansky, how Meyer Lansky took over the Cincinnati Ballet. The Newport story is very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It all kind of dovetails with the same story that we're talking about here, yeah, which is basically these are the pioneers that gave us Jewish privilege by criminals like Meyer Lansky and Mo Dalitz laundering money with the ADL, and the ADL then ensuring that anybody who referred to Mo Dalitz would be called an anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. It's an unbeatable combination.
Yeah, that goes way back, as early as 1908. I was reading about this, the New York Police Commissioner named Bingman, Theodore Bingman, wrote a report about criminality and how it broke down ethnically. And he, when the report concluded that the Jewish crime rate was three times the general crime rate and higher than that of Italians. And for that report, he was forced to apologize and then resign. This is 1908.
In 1908. Yeah. He was ahead of his time.
Because one thing we do get when we talk about some like organized crime, you know, we're very familiar with Goodfellas or The Godfather, even The Sopranos on television, and how you know, mafia is considered an Italian or a Sicilian thing. But one thing that people like Coppola and Scorsese do is they pin it all on Italians, right? And that's what most people think of. Oh, you know, there's a marginal treatment of Jews both in The Godfather and The Sopranos. Mean. But still, we think of it, you know, we think of Italians. But really,
that's right.
It's a Jewish mafia that was really became dominant and ascendant in the 20th century and became legit because these Jewish gangsters also got heavily involved in politics. The Jewish charity that they used to fund the Zionist cause in the late 40s. And people like Hank Greenspun, and then of course, you know, Mo Dalitz and Lansky, and who's the other guy that produced out in Hollywood, Arnon Milchin, who's still alive.
Right. Yeah.
He can openly brag about his espionage on behalf of the Israeli state and not suffer any consequences. That's Jewish privilege.
Yeah. Or there's this whole farce about the Russians influencing our election. Has anyone heard that the Israelis have influenced our election? Have you heard that story? You know, there's no Russian collusion, and the Russian collusion that you could prove, it turns out to be Jewish anyway.
Yeah, because the Russian mafia, yeah.
Because the Russian mafia is Jewish, mm-hmm. But no one's allowed to talk about that. So you have a place like Brighton Beach where the criminality is flourishing because no cop, no DA in Manhattan wants to take on the Jewish mafia. He'll be called an anti-Semite. So again, it's Jewish privilege for criminals.
Well, the weakness is because all these things, whether it's vices, vices are always sold as freedom, whether it's sex or gambling or whatever, pornography, right? And one thing I get throughout history, reading history, is that when Christian, particularly Catholic identity is strong, consciousness is strong, it holds back or restrains the Jews. And as soon as when Catholic power wanes or that identity is lost, then in the name of freedom, the naked public square that Leo Pfeffer created with his activism, it's the Talmud that fills the vacuum.
That's right. Nature abhors a vacuum. Yeah. I just did a piece on a movie review of Midsummer, which is a horror movie that's set in Sweden, which allowed me, this will be in the September issue of Culture Wars, but it allowed me to look into Ingmar Bergman. And we all knew, or I used to go to see his films when I was a teenager, and he had a monopoly on the artsy film look. He was to film sort of what Mapplethorpe was to photography. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There was a look, and Mapplethorpe was the guy who created the image of the heroic homosexual. Before, they were just kind of creepy guys who drove around at night and tried to pick you up and that type of thing. Where after Mapplethorpe, they became heroic figures. Well, the same thing happened with art with Bergman, and he was like the best propagandist for atheism the world ever found. And watch a film like Seven Seal. which is watchable. It becomes not insufferable like his later films. What you see is a great propagandist, you know, a great propagandist. So I'm looking, there's a film, a book that came out, Swedish Cinema and the Sexual Revolution. I thought, well, that's interesting. So I start reading it, and it turns out that Bergman was part of an international conspiracy at this point. It involved Olof Palme. That was the guy who implemented it in Sweden. Sweden was famous for social engineering. Gunnar Myrdal came over here and inaugurated the era of social engineering by that book, The American Dilemma. It was Swedish socialism, which got the cutting edge of enlightened thought and political organization.
Isn't he the one that declared that people will no longer be allowed to live where they choose?
That's right. It's in that book. Yeah. So thank you, Gunnar. Thank you for coming up. We know you didn't write the book, but thanks for the gesture anyway. So I'm reading through the book, and it's Olof Palme and Ingmar Bergman and Max von Sydow and Gunnar, I forget his name now. He was a great actor. And, Bjorn Bjornsson. And suddenly it's Harry Schein. Wait a minute. That doesn't sound Jewish. That doesn't sound Swedish. Well, it turns out he's an Austrian Jew who shows up in Sweden, and he becomes hugely influential in Sweden, like overnight. He founds a film institute, and guess what the film institute says? Pornography has no bad effects on anyone. So in addition to lobbying for pornography in Sweden, he's the go-between between Bergman and Hollywood. And what's going on here? We're back at 1964. Guess what's going on in 1964? The Jews want to break the production code in Hollywood. Well, it turns out it wasn't just America. That Schein was orchestrating this with Bergman. Bergman was a crucial figure here because Bergman had a lock on artsy film. And you needed, at this point, if it had redeeming social value, well, it wasn't obscene. No matter how much TNA you saw, it wasn't obscene. And so we had movies like Swedish movies like I Am Curious Yellow, which is, you know, speeches by Martin Luther King and then a couple copulating and then speeches by Martin Luther King. It had redeeming social value.
That's the Roth decision, right?
So this is happening. So it turns out that Schein collaborated with Bergman in the 1963 film called The Silence, 64, I believe. And this was, I don't ever remember seeing The Silence. It did show here. I never remember. I remember watching, you know, Seven Seal, Virgin Spring, stuff like that. Never saw this. It was, according to the author of the article in this book, it was calculated to be a code breaker. It was designed to be a code breaker. And it was a code breaker. It broke the code in Germany. And I cover that in my whole Werner Heisenberg book, Werner Heisenberg and Jewish Science. It wrecked the Obscenity Commission, because the Catholics were, you know, they had lost their nerve. And you go up to a Catholic, an artsy, fartsy Catholic who's on the Legion of Decency Review Board, and he wants to be liked by people in polite company. And so they just browbeat him and say, how can you say this is obscene? It's art. And the Catholic doesn't know what to say. It didn't break the code in America. It did not do it. It didn't work here. But the 1 year later, they broke the code with The Pawnbroker, which, as I told you before, is Holocaust porn. Yeah. They had to bring out the big guns, use the Holocaust to break the code.
So it's Holocaust and art. The same strategy was used in Cincinnati in the 80s with the late 80s with the litigation regarding Mapplethorpe exhibit, right? Where they called it art and they intimidated the jury.
Right. They intimidated the jury. The guy's saying, well, it looks like the guy has a bullwhip up his ass. But if you're telling me it's art, I guess it's art.
Who am I to question it, right?
This is what happened across the board, and the Jews were behind it in every instance. There's not one instance where the Jews weren't behind the over, including Cincinnati.
And they were targeted a town like Cincinnati because of its conservative and particularly its Catholic influence.
That's right. That's exactly. And it was revenge for the Catholic sheriff, George Ratterman, the Notre Dame quarterback, who drove Mo Dallas out of Newport.
That's another part of that Catholic identity, which I think I pointed out to you when I interviewed you on that particular subject, is that he was a Catholic that was elected, despite the, didn't they slip him a Mickey, try to put him in bed with a prostitute or something?
Yeah, but, they put it, he ran for a sheriff and members picking up a drink, talking to a casino owner, and then he wakes up and he's in bed with a prostitute with no clothes on. And they framed him, you know, and his wife took him to the doctor, and he had knockout drops enough to kill the entire football team, and he survived. And then he won. And John and Robert Kennedy got behind him, and they cleaned up. The FBI did good for once and drove the
and they criminal. Knew who he was because they were Catholic, of course, and they knew of Notre Dame and Notre.
Right,
and
they were football fans, and they watched him at Notre Dame. So, you know, so
it's like yeah. It wasn't the, you know, it's like people identified Notre Dame because of the football team, the Four Horsemen, and these things. But it's funny. This shows just that just because they, you know, they were cultural Catholics. They showed this unity.
That's right.
Chasing out the you know, the gamblers, the pornographers, and the gangsters. It's
and they saw it, I think, as a Catholic Jewish battle. As the Jews certainly saw it that way, and they vowed revenge on Catholic Cincinnati, and they got it through Mapplethorpe. And now Dan has his own casino there.
The culture, they're able to impose the Cultural Revolution on there.
That's right. They get, this is Jewish privilege. They get to impose their culture on you. I'll give you one more instance. Now, I'm in Chicago and I meet this, you know, big Chicago cop who, you know, told me that, you know, when you said the Lithuanians in Marquette Park had a right to throw rocks at Martin Luther King to defend their neighborhood, he said, my grandfather said the same thing. So he was probably out there throwing rocks. You know, this scandalized a number of people on the internet, but I stand by it. But anyway, so this man is now subjected to diversity training as a cop. Well, guess who the sponsor of diversity training is? Guess who's in charge of it?
The ADL.
The ADL, of course. and guess what the diversity trainer is?
I suppose he's a black homosexual. I don't know.
No, he's a Jewish homosexual.
Okay, well, close. Okay.
And so he gets to impose his views on this Catholic. Now, how do you do that? How do you do that? The answer is Jewish privilege.
Yeah, the entire structure of the...
Catholic walked into Goldman Sachs and said, you guys have to have rosary training now. We're going to teach you how to say the rosary, and if you don't like it, I'm going to get you fired.
Yep.
Well, that's exactly what's happening to the police force in Chicago.
Well,
it's the imposition of Jewish privilege. Jewish privilege allows these people to impose their views on the cops in the name of diversity.
And don't you, if you're an FBI agent, don't you have to go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, well, yes, and this is a type, again, Jewish privilege. So the cop understands what's going on, and he's completely disruptive in class. So the Jewish homosexual takes him aside, and what's he going to do, beat him up? The guy is, like, huge. He's, like, 6'5", and weighs about 300 pounds. And so the Jewish homosexual says to him, he says, you know, you have to pass this course. Because if you don't, you'll be in trouble. You'll lose your job. Now, how's that for intimidation, huh? And the guy says, okay, flunk me. I'll take the course again. I'll be back. I'll disrupt every single class you teach, you know? Well, that's the type of – who gave these people the right to do this? This is Jewish privilege. This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, this guy seems willing, at least temperamentally, to fight back and sort of.
Yes, and that's the difference between him and the younger people. The younger men on the force are just totally intimidated. They don't like it. They don't know what to do. They can't understand what's going on, and they're angry, you know. So do they take out their anger, too? I suppose it's possible, you know. Take it out on you. You got a ticket because this guy was just browbeaten by this Jewish homosexual in his diversity training course because he's angry and he doesn't want to go home and kick the dog. So he gives you a ticket. I mean, you're putting the cops in an impossible situation here. And the whole point is, yes, and you're putting everyone in an impossible situation. So stop doing it.
In the article, you also cover a little bit of the Charlottesville episode, and this lady Roberta Kaplan, who's particularly
tell me how she describes herself. How does she describe herself?
Is she a what was that a
chubby lesbian kike?
There we go.
Now, Tim, your YouTube video is going to be banned now.
Oh, every time I have you on, they take it off now. So that's okay.
we just said chubby lesbian kike. That's hate speech, mm-hmm. and it's going to be banned. Now wait a minute. She's the one who described herself that way. Is she banned from YouTube for doing that? No. Why not? Well, because it's Jewish privilege, isn't it? She gets to say the most outrageous type of stuff. And if you quote her, you'll be guilty of hate speech.
And she was involved in this, the Symes versus, this litigation where she's suing, participants, although the participants had a permit to be there. But she's claiming, that people were traumatized by some of the James Fields incident where the car ran over the counter-protester.
Right. So what, she's representing a woman who said she was traumatized because she was there when it happened. The car was nowhere near her. She didn't get hurt.
She's not hurt.
But she was traumatized. Well, look, Roberta, I'm traumatized by just thinking about you. Does that give me the right? So she raised $11 million from donors so that she could pay herself a fat salary and engage in a frivolous lawsuit. This is all Jewish privilege.
Oh, I mean, this is a frivolous. As an officer of the court, and she's, this is done commonly, of course. I'm not naive about this, but she openly, talks about her strategy is to go after these people, get judgments against them to suppress their free speech. Then she mocks them for having no money. And then you point out how their position and their problems are often a result of what? Right? Usury.
Yeah.
So
why are you in your other mother's basement? Mm-hmm. Well, because you have student debt and you can't get a job. And what do you do in your mother's basement? You watch pornography. Well, there's a Jewish angle to all of this. Okay? We just heard that Paul Singer is notorious for exporting jobs, American jobs, to Israel. He's one of the biggest supporters of Donald Trump. He is one of the three reasons, along with Sheldon Adelson and Bernard Marcus, that we don't have a nuclear agreement with the Iranians anymore. We are on the brink of war because three rich Jews didn't like the agreement. This is Jewish privilege, isn't it?
Yeah, it is interesting that, when Lansky was having his legal problems Israel didn't accept him, they sent him back to the United States, although he was indicted but never convicted. But nevertheless, they refused to take him. I think at the time it was because Golda Meir wanted to get some jets from the U.S. government. And she had to negotiate, and she said to serve up Meyer Lansky to get the planes. But now they wouldn't even have to make that deal because they're in such firm control of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, well, wasn't that what sprung Jonathan Pollard?
Yeah.
Wasn't that some type of deal? I forget the details now, but I know he suddenly was no longer in prison, in spite of the opposition of the entire the State Department, the military establishment, anyone who thinks that espionage is a bad thing, which a lot of people do, was against it, and he got sprung anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably named a street after him in Tel Aviv.
Yep, and well, a lot of this, it goes back to what's the problem here? The problem is, America being a free, pluralistic society is vulnerable to these things because we don't have the corporate, the corporate or integral understanding of a traditional society. The good thing is, there's no real central Christian identity or belief, and so it creates a vacuum, or there's a lack of ability to organize or coalesce to understand these things. Some of the remedies that would have been proposed by, proposed by the Catholic Church in the Jewish question, or by St. John Capistrano, are simply not possible in pluralistic, America. Idea that the notion that there are certain rules, certain society should be governed by, you know, by certain Christian rules. Therefore, those who don't accept, you know, those Christian rules have to be treated differently. And that's something that simply, you know, isn't accepted, view would not be accepted in modern America.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. So you have to argue on other grounds.
Yeah, yeah. You know, both the remedies, you know, the remedy that he proposes is segregation, right? I mean, unless they convert, but again, there is, America isn't, you know, isn't a Christian, much less a Catholic nation. It's a polarized society. It's a, you know, it's a,
right,
you know, free, free it, you know, so.
It changed with Napoleon when he emancipated the Jews. Because now they had the fiction of being citizens, and everybody, the Frenchmen, complained bitterly when Napoleon made his way back to Paris from the Battle of Jena. The people in Strasbourg complained bitterly that the Jews did not act like citizens. They were only interested in their own self-interest, you know, and they would exploit that position. Now that they had more freedom, they would use it to exploit the native population. That's been a problem. Throughout Jewish
history. Well, there's no, without a central guiding position, something like Christianity, there's no sense of the common good and what the good society is. So it's a
free-for-all. And we're watching, I mean, we had our run. Now there is absolutely no consensus whatsoever on anything. If by consensus you mean something that's willingly accepted.
Yeah.
We have codes that are imposed upon us. Because no one accepts anything willingly anymore, but we're witnessing the end of the American.
Well, that's the irony of it all, is in the name of freedom, we're getting more tyranny, right? Which is the old trick. Because when you had mediating institutions like the Catholic Church that drawing its power from these ethnic neighborhoods, you had strong, you know, these parishes, these neighborhoods that had strong Catholic ethnic identity, the Catholic Church was able to flex its cultural and political muscle and hold back these other forces, these other influences, particularly Jewish influence. Now with that broken, there's nothing holding them back. And then they come in, just like you mentioned, how, you know, in the 60s they supported the free speech movement to tear down institutions and to disrupt the moral order. Now they're against that free speech, because when you use free speech and open, you know, dialogue and facts and rational arguments to uphold the moral order, reestablish moral order, or hold them accountable for their actions that they brag about in other books, whether it's the influence over Hollywood or their activism towards abortion and pornography. When you criticize them for being influential in these things, they want to shut down free speech. Or when you point out that they are indeed well-organized and they exercise inordinate influence. Well, if you have that power, you have to have some sort of accountability, but they're going to shut down free speech so they have no accountability.
That's right.
So there's more tyranny than ever. Just like, you know, the moment that these communities are smashed and people no longer have ethnic identity, they feel obligated, you know, to support their ethnic groups and with their traditions, and whether it's church, whether it's, you know, ethnic or religious and these things. Well, that is somewhat restraining, meaning that you're compelled to support your ethnic group and your family. But they come in with all these micro-regulations, whether it's busing, forced integration, speech codes, you know, being denied banking services just because you have a certain political point of view, or,
yeah,
you know, employment and these things. There's far more tyranny under their system than there is under the older order.
I mean, that's right. You know. That's right, because the old order had a rationality to it, and this has no rationality. This is what happens when you repudiate rationality. You have to have an arbitrary code imposed on you. And arbitrary codes are tyrannical by nature. They are the will of the powerful imposed on those who do not have power. That's it. That's all they are.
We're back to Thrasymachus, right?
That's right. That's exactly where we are. And so we've just botched about 2,500 years of civilization.
Which gets, as we close out the interview, that's a good way to, I think, a segue to talk about your new book, because this is all about Logos, isn't it?
Yes, that's about it. I'm starting to see that this was man's kind of understanding of the ultimate reality. And you have to have some understanding of the ultimate reality in order to order your society. Mm-hmm. And what happened over this period of time is that there were sincere efforts to understand things. Some people got it wrong, and then suddenly there was a nosedive after the death of Hegel into materialism. And those people believe that the ultimate reality is balls, little balls bumping into each other. They're called atoms, and that's the ultimate reality. And that is has a catastrophic effect on society. So what you have is the comeback, a huge comeback on the part of the Catholic Church at this point, with Civiltà Cattolica being founded around the time of the Revolution of 1848, and then the rise of Neo-Thomism. The resurrection of Logos in an era at the, if you look just over the other side of the wall, the Catholic wall, you have Karl Marx and materialism and revolution and no philosophy. Philosophy died over the course of the 19th century, and the main man who presided over the funeral was Nietzsche. There's no way you can talk about Nietzsche's hatred of Logos as philosophy. It's not. It's the opposite of philosophy. You know, but at this point, the church preserved it. And then, you know, it goes on. It goes on and on. But that's pretty much, if you have a society that believes that the Trinity is the ultimate reality, well, you're going to have a very different society. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. And that is basically the point of Schaeben. He had a brilliant treatise on the Trinity. He did what Hegel thought he was going to do. And in that sense, he big step forward in terms of Logos. But again, you have to have the political power to enforce it. And this is what got eroded over that same period of time.
And it was intentionally eroded. It was attacked.
Well, yeah, of course it was.
Yeah. I mean, you're right about
the Risorgimento, just the political attack in Italy against the papal states, all of that type of stuff. So, and they were being fueled by this materialist ideology. And the church at a certain point started to internalize the commands of its oppressors and said, well, maybe we don't have the ultimate reality. Maybe we're just here to make people feel good. Maybe Karl Marx is right. Maybe religion is opium. You know, maybe it is. I mean, there are people who actually express that. Religion is subjective. Reality is physics. Well, that's catastrophic. We're living in this, the aftermath of that era. You still have people like Richard Dawkins and the other three famous atheist twits who would give an attempt to defend that thesis. Mm-hmm. You know, but we're beyond that. You know, we're beyond that.
And again, you cannot have a political order if you don't have internal order. The people have to have some sort of sense of objective truth and what's right and wrong.
That John Adams said that. We have no constitution that functions in the absence of a moral people. So if you don't have self-control, you can't have political control, democratic political control, if you can't control yourself. Mm-hmm. So it goes hand in hand. So obviously the people who want totalitarian, complete tyrannical control over your culture are going to want to undermine your morals, because that's the way they're going to gain control over you.
Yeah, and that, of course, that gets the, you know, Aldous Huxley wrote about that.
Yes, and so did I.
Yeah. And so you appeal to the passions, excite the passions.
Yeah, libido dominandi, yep. Sexual liberation and political
isn't control. That what it's all, you know, when it gets down to whether it's the homosexual's proxy, sexual liberation, abortion, all that is the flight from responsibility and morality in pursuit of passions, disordered
That's
passions.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And you think you're getting what you want and you end up. So I said in the review of Midsommar, all pornographic movies get remade as horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
That's a rule of life.
Monsters of the Id, your book. Yeah, in other
words. That's right. That's where I deal with that too.
Yeah, so, well, listen, Dr. Jones, I want to thank you for coming. Anything else you want to say? I think we kind of, got the.
Yes, go to culturewars.com. We have a brand new website. It's easy to order. We're selling lots of books. You want to be in on that change in consciousness that's taking place right now.
Excellent. Okay, well, I recommend everyone to go to culturewars.com, subscribe to the magazine, also get the books that are there. There's a lifetime of reading there, and it will change your life if you read it. And I do recommend it. Thank you, Dr. Jones. I'll be posting soon. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, Tim.
Good night, then.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.